This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the impact of the pandemic on nurses of color, and in particular, the Filipino and Filipino-American community. We're looking at the Filipino community specifically because many Filipinos either work or know other Filipinos that work within the healthcare industry, and there's a reason for this. To learn about the history of Filipino nurses and Filipinos in healthcare, we're joined by James Zarzurias, Director of Yuchenko Philippine Studies Program and Associate Professor of History at the University of San Francisco. James, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
I was going to say, I think we have a different time zone here, don't we?
Afternoon, yes.
James, is there some truth behind this idea that a lot of Filipinos go into healthcare?
Yeah, I think one of the prevailing stereotypes out there is that there are a lot of Filipinos who are in nursing in particular, and the healthcare and medical industry in general, but definitely in nursing. And part of it is, a couple of things. One is a long history of nursing being a popular profession in the Philippines, going back to the U.S. colonial period. And part of it, too, is some kind of racial stereotypes about Filipinos being inherently hospitable or inherently caring people that are tied to certain ideas around Asian American identities and kind of what their personality traits are.
And how do you differentiate between, you know, what is the stereotypical idea versus what I guess is part of what's been going on historically?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just kind of take it back since we were talking a little bit about history. And, you know, one of the reasons why there are many Filipinos who are in nursing and in the industry in general is because during the U.S. colonial period between 1898 and 1946, many American government officials and medical workers and missionaries, actually, many of them actually came from the Midwest as well, tried to establish more Western-style medical facilities and practices in the Philippines as part of this kind of broader concept of benevolent assimilation, trying to quote-unquote westernize or quote-unquote Americanize the Philippines. And as a result of that structure, you have now generations of Filipinos from the Philippines who moved to the United States, who speak English as well, were taught in American-style medical facilities and schools, particularly nursing schools, and then they bring that skill set and knowledge to them to the United States and other predominantly English-speaking countries. So there are, of course, many Filipino nurses as well in Canada and Australia, throughout Europe as well. So there is a long-standing history of that, and part of it also is because the United States, American-based hospitals, for example, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, many major cities recruited Filipino nurses specifically going back to the 1950s, but certainly by the 1960s and 1970s until today because of this legacy and this history and because, again, of the cultural ties between the United States and the Philippines, namely English being kind of one of the primary reasons why they're seen as an attractive workforce.
Is any of this due to what we keep hearing about with a nursing shortage? Do you think part of that has played into, I guess, our present time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when there was a nursing shortage in the 1960s and 70s in the United States, it still is the case today. And the Philippines continues to be a major player in sending Filipino nurses abroad because, again, obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened hospital staffing around the world. And back here in the United States in particular, of course, in areas with lower vaccination rates and fewer hospitals to go around, particularly, let's say, rural areas, Filipino nurses oftentimes are recruited or are asked to staff even more to kind of pick up and help with some of the shortages. One of the things that is difficult for a lot of Filipino nurses is that if particularly for immigrants, you know, they're adjusting to cultural differences. If they are newer and don't have seniority on the staff, they might not get the most desirable shifts or types of roles at a hospital or any kind of medical facility. So it has really disproportionately affected the Filipino and Filipino-American community, even down to their families, many of them who are also in the medical field and in especially is as nurses.
Yeah, that's something I was wondering, actually, as you were saying that, is whether when recruiting nurses from the Philippines, are they giving them, you know, the worst shifts and the overtime and all this stuff versus others?
Yeah, I think that is, you know, that's a deeper issue that's actually been a problem for decades, if not generations, frankly. You know, some of it is depending on, again, seniority. Some of it is also, frankly, unfortunately, due to racial discrimination. You know, there's research out there. One of the best history books out there about this history of Filipino nurses to the United States is Catherine Sinisa Choi's Empire of Care. And in that book and in other works and research, there is a lot of concrete evidence of particularly American hospitals that may be giving Filipino nurses, especially if they're immigrants, you know, the overnight shifts or maybe types of tasks that are not as, again, desirable or, you know, compared to other roles in the hospital.
You mentioned earlier that the U.S. tried to westernize healthcare, it sounds like, in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Did that impact the way nursing, I guess, did that make more folks who are doing nursing in the Philippines want to move to the U.S. because they had that background? Did it make them more desirable for opportunities here? Or I guess, what is it that created sort of the move?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There has been a long stream of Filipino nurse migration to the United States. Again, partly because the way in which U.S. colonialism operated. You know, among the legacies of American imperialism and colonialism in the Philippines between 1898 and 1946 was doing things like making English one of the official languages of the Philippines. That is still one of the official languages today. Having U.S.-style educational systems, even down to government. They have, like in the United States, you know, a three-branch government. You know, they have a bicameral legislature, they have a Supreme Court, and they have the executive branch, you know. And so there's a lot of similarities. And, you know, being told or pressured or, you know, growing up in the Philippines during this time and even till today, anecdotally, you know, I'm also Filipino American from Filipino immigrant parents. You know, there are many promises and dreams that are out there, you know, supposedly if you move to America, and that's part of the enticement for many Filipino nurses to move. You know, again, that's one reason, but also due to the fact that the United States has often needed nurses to staff hospitals, hospices, and other areas of the healthcare industry. And so it does seem like a promising venture for Filipinos to move to America. And especially if you're nursing, it is seen as a very stable profession. And that's why many Filipinos and Filipino Americans, and even second, third generation Filipino Americans today, do go into nursing because it's around them. They have a mother, potentially, you know, an uncle or an aunt, you know, other relatives who are in the field. And that is seen as, again, a stable profession, stable income, and one that the Filipino-American community is very familiar with.
Well, later in the show, we're going to talk a little bit more about the number of Filipino nurses and healthcare workers that have been impacted by COVID and died. Do you think Filipinos have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic, and it's something that we haven't really been talking about?
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, when the pandemic hit, you know, many Filipino nurses, like all medical workers and those on the front lines, were just unbelievably impacted. And, you know, I think from what we know, Filipinos are about 4% of the workforce in terms of registered nurses, but about a quarter or more have passed away or have been impacted directly by COVID-19. And while that seems as a somewhat small statistic, it is still very important and still devastating. And Filipino nurses today are still grappling with these challenges. You know, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that if you're a Filipino immigrant nurse in particular, especially those who might have come here in recent years, when confronted with the COVID-19 pandemic, they're not only adjusting to cultural differences as a new immigrant to the country. They're trying to confront and manage that. They're also trying to deal with, in some parts of the United States or in some hospitals, acts of discrimination towards them because they're immigrants or because they're Asian American. And there are a lot of growing anti-Asian sentiments because of the COVID-19 pandemic and anti-Asian rhetoric because of this. And then they're also dealing with just the actual pandemic itself. So there's a lot of challenges that they're confronted with. And it's not just the Filipino nurses who are in the field, but also, again, their families. You know, one thing that was very alarming to a lot of Filipino Americans is that many of their families were especially at risk because it's not uncommon for Filipino families to have multiple generations living under one household. And as we've all seen during the pandemic, you know, there were many instances of medical workers, frontline workers across racial lines who put their families and loved ones in danger because when they came home, they could have been exposed and you're in tight living quarters. Well, for Filipino families, it was not uncommon even today to see, you know, let's say a mother who's a nurse who's coming home to their children, potentially exposing them. Maybe you have grandparents in the household, maybe an aunt or an uncle. And so it did create these instances of increased risk. And unfortunately, there were many stories of Filipino nurses who not only got COVID or unfortunately passed from it, but even their relatives and loved ones. So it's still very alarming. The pandemic is clearly still not over. And this is a challenge that the Filipino and Filipino American community are grappling with, not just here in the United States, but worldwide.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left here. James, what would you like to see happening moving forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, thanks to the work of a lot of activists, nonprofit groups and nurses associations, they are holding hospitals and government leaders accountable. But I would certainly love to see more direct legislation and acts that protect the medical field in general, but especially those who are most vulnerable. And in this case, this includes Filipino and immigrant nurses who, again, often are tackling this on the front lines and dealing with this in more dangerous circumstances. So hopefully this will change and improve as we continue to battle the pandemic.
Well, thank you so much. James Arcedillas is the director of the Yuchenko Philippine Studies Program and associate professor of history at the University of San Francisco. We'll be back. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the impact of the pandemic on Filipino and Filipino-American healthcare workers. We'll talk about the number of deaths we saw among nurses and other healthcare workers from COVID-19 and hear the personal stories and experiences of Filipino-American healthcare workers during the pandemic. We're joined now by Zeni Triunfo Cortez, president of National Nurses United, to learn about finding data on healthcare worker deaths from COVID-19. Welcome to the program, Zeni.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Zeni, what prompted your group to work on this report?
First and foremost, we are the largest nursing organization, association, union group in the United States. We represent over 175 nurses throughout the country. And it is just but fitting that we protect our nurses as well as the healthcare workers that we work along with. And so this is really important to us.
This report was released earlier this year in March. What numbers and data did you find then?
Well, we put together the sense of omission report. And because there was lack of reporting and transparency among healthcare agencies that should be looking into this, and also our government, unfortunately, we, as an organization, started looking into the statistics, and it's very heartbreaking, and I still continue to choke up, that we have registered nurses of 476 who have died and about 4,184 healthcare workers who have died due to COVID. And we know that this is underreported because our organization was looking at obituaries, GoFundMe accounts. You know, there was really no hard data or consistent reporting that was being done. And so we took the task of really looking into public records so that we could come up with the numbers. So again, with over close to 5,000 healthcare workers, including nurses, we know that it is underreported.
That's so sad to hear that there's no way to keep track of this information. And it sounds like your group is on the forefront of trying to make sure that, that it's out there. Did the numbers surprise you?
It really didn't, because at the beginning of the pandemic, when we first heard about this from our colleagues from around the world, we generated a letter to the World Health Organization and to our CDC and OSHA that there is a virus that's killing healthcare workers around the world. Maybe the government, the U.S. government, should look into this. And I think we also copy furnished the former president, and of course it fell on deaf ears, you know, just so maybe they were looking at a bunch of wimpy nurses. But it was really concerning because our colleagues from other countries were dying, and we knew it was just a matter of time that it would be coming here in the U.S., and so it did.
Have the numbers changed since the report was released? Have you seen any differences?
Well, I think there's a slight increase, but again, because of the lack of consistent reporting and transparency, it's still very hard to track the numbers. Different states have different ways of doing it, but again, there's no consistent manner of which reporting is done. And so it's still very concerning because we hear from friends, colleagues, you know, again, public records, obituaries, GoFundMe accounts, that nurses and other healthcare workers are still dying.
If you're tuning in and have a question or comment for our program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Zeni Triunfo-Cortez, president of National Nurses United, to learn more about finding data on healthcare worker deaths from COVID-19, as well as the effect of the pandemic on the Filipino-American community and healthcare workers. Zeni, you mentioned that finding the data was really hard, and you had to go through these obituaries or GoFundMes. What I was wondering is part of the problem that a cause of death isn't always linked to COVID, even though, let's say, someone died of COVID, they might say it was something else?
Well, that's a possibility. That's a good, accurate statement that you're making. And it's really, again, concerning that, you know, it's not just coincidence that a nurse would die during this pandemic when they're extremely or actively exposed to the elements of their workplace.
Is there enough being done to record the number of healthcare worker deaths right now?
I think the Biden administration is trying, but again, there's still lack of cooperation among the states. And not to pick on Indiana, where this radio show is coming from, but the state of Indiana has never publicly reported all healthcare worker infections or deaths. And our organization has counted about 90 healthcare worker deaths in Indiana, including 8 registered nurses during the pandemic. Just again, using the data sources that we have been using, which is the news report, social media, GoFundMe campaigns, and the federal CMS nursing home data set. But again, there's no consistency and again, no transparency, which is really heartbreaking for me and for all of us.
Is this transparency and lack of transparency something new to the pandemic, or has this always been an issue within the industry?
I think it has always been that way in the industry, and more so with this pandemic. I mean, it has just exacerbated it, because I guess the hospital industry, the healthcare industry, does not want to take full account of how the healthcare workers, the nurses, were not protected at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were asking, begging, crying for personal protective equipment. And even the regulators, you know, the healthcare agencies like OSHA, the Department of Health, all of them were saying that, you know, you don't have to wear a mask. A bandana would suffice. Mm-hmm. But we know it's not, because, again, we have been informed and we know what was going on around the world. And even in some hospitals, nurses were disciplined for wearing masks. And, you know, the managers and supervisors were saying that we were raising a lot of alarm, you know, unnecessary alarm, or, you know, we were scaring our patients. But we were trying to protect ourselves, because if we are not protected, then the people that we care for are not protected as well. And so that was the beginning. And then we kept pushing and crying and begging. And ultimately, with the help of our union, we were able to secure the proper personal protective equipment, but not all of the nurses or healthcare workers in other states, where, again, they were retaliated when they spoke out in the public about not being protected. And it's like James has said in the beginning, you know, we go home to our families, we interact with the communities. If we're the carriers of the virus, it's, again, not right. It's unconscionable that we will be the perpetrators of this pandemic. And so we wanted to protect the public as well as protect ourselves.
You know, I almost forgot about the early pandemic days, and I'm now remembering the lack of PPEs and all of that stuff that was going on. And now knowing what we know, I mean, that just sounds so scary to have experienced that. What was that like for you?
For me, it was very concerning, heartbreaking, and fortunately or unfortunately for me, I do not have my elder parents. They have been gone, but I have grandnephews and grandnieces that I once in a while would see, that, you know, again, fortunately, they don't live with me. But every day that you come to work, you never know whether you'll be able to make it through another day. You never know whether you will be hit with the virus. You never know whether you have enough protective equipment to use for the day, because back in the day, we were told to keep reusing the same masks, the same gowns over and over. And back in the day also, they were not isolating COVID positive patients. We were taking care of non-COVID patients with the COVID positive patients. So who's to say that we were not cross-infecting, you know, the patients? But I don't know what was it with the hospital industry that they don't understand. The nurses and the healthcare workers are there with the patients. We are there 24/7 at the bedside. And yet these folks who are making the decisions are in their offices, high up in their offices, protected within the four walls of their offices. They do not know what was going on at the bedside. That's why we were begging, crying. And I remember coming home each night, laying awake all night, thinking that, did I come home with the virus? Am I giving it to my husband? Or if I go back to work again, will another patient die? Or will I, again, hold the hands of a dying patient because families were not allowed to come in? So those were the kinds of thoughts that you know, keep going through our minds. And I think even to this day, a lot of the nurses are just tired, not just physical, but mentally tired. And we are all suffering from moral distress, meaning that we knew back then that we wanted to do the right thing, but we were pushed not to because of the lack of resources and the lack of support.
Yeah, that's got to be tough. Just everything that you're talking about, you know, I'm really sorry you had to go through all of that. And I hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we thank you and everyone who's been working on the front lines. When we talk about the effect of the pandemic on the Filipino healthcare workers, do you have any numbers on how it's been impacting that community?
Yeah, sure. Again, the numbers would be underreported, but what we have is that there are 476 registered nurses that we know of who have died, and we were only able to identify the ethnicity of 455 of those nurses. Out of those 455 that we were able to identify, we know that 221 of them are nurses of color. Then out of the 221 nurses of color who have died, 96 of those are Filipinos. And if you look at the percentage, it's a high percentage of Filipino nurses, you know, who have died because of COVID. And for the Black nurses, there's 78 of them. And for the Latinx nurses, there's 34. So within the colored group of nurses, the Filipinos rank the highest.
And it also sounds just in general, nurses of color are more impacted, or am I understanding that?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement to make. It's again, it's unfortunate that it has to come to that. I think for Filipinos, I might say, is that a lot of us work in the critical care area where a lot of the very sick COVID patients are housed. And so we had a higher rate of exposure because of that. We also because of the lack of PPE. And I think it's, again, a statement that I have made. Filipinos culturally are not the ones who would rock the boat or make waves to complain, because they treat their patients like their families. We just go with it. We use the best of what we have, given what we have, and continue to do the work. And I think that was when we lacked the PPE, we were overworked, and we were overstressed, and that we would forego of our own safety, you know, to care for our patients. And I think that, I would say, made or are some of the reasons that made up the high rate of Filipino nurses dying.
We're about to take a break, but before we do, can you tell us what protections are in place for nurses and healthcare workers on the front lines right now?
So right now, we do have some of the personal protective equipment that we need, but again, it's not enough, and it's not true for all nurses all over the country. Then we had pushed the Biden administration to issue an emergency temporary standard. And a good thing that President Biden put together a COVID task force and asked OSHA, federal OSHA, to create the first emergency temporary standard since 1983. And this emergency temporary standard, which we call ETS for short, mandates all employers to have written infection control safety standards and implementation plans. it requires employers to issue life-saving respiratory protection and also to admit the fact that COVID is also transmitted via aerosol. And so they are required to provide us with respiratory, you know, one of those hoods. And I don't know if you've seen it, you know, with the astronauts wearing them.
Yeah.
They're required to provide us that if it's needed. And also that they have a robust notification system, you know, to notify employees when they're infected. And then also to provide us with testing, screening, and all of that. But unfortunately, this emergency temporary standard is expiring on December 21st. That's why we're pushing and, again, begging that the ETS be reissued or that it becomes permanent so that we can have the protections that we need.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our discussion on the pandemic's impact on Filipino-American healthcare workers. And with us again is Zeni Triunfo-Cortez, president of National Nurses United. We're learning about her experience working as a Filipino healthcare worker during the pandemic. And before the break, we touched upon some of the protections that are in place right now for nurses and healthcare workers on the front lines. Zeni, what protections for nurses are your group pushing for right now?
Before we went on break, I was mentioning about the ETS. So our organization is pushing that it become a permanent standard so that we will continue to have improved protections and enhance OSHA enforcement activities in many states across the nation. Just to give you a little bit of a background on that, last year, during the height of the pandemic, our nurses filed more than 12,000 complaints because of health and safety issues in our workplaces. We filed it with OSHA. But unfortunately, out of those 12,000 complaints that we have made, OSHA only opened 333 inspections out of those. And so they were not really looking into what the nurses and the healthcare workers are complaining about. And so with this ETS, we are, part of it is that if a complaint is filed, then it needs to be looked at. So those are the kinds of things that we are fighting for. And the ETS is a comprehensive, we have a comprehensive list. And we are hoping that President Biden will again ask OSHA to do what's best for the nurses and the other healthcare workers. And it's just about right, because if we are not protected, then the patients and the public that we care for or interact with are not protected as well. And we need to make sure that we are not the hub or the center of contaminating or, you know, transmitting the virus. And it's just but right that we continue to be protected. And we have the employers and the healthcare industry held accountable for protecting us and the public.
Do you feel that nurses of color and Filipino nurses and Filipino American nurses have received enough recognition for their work during the pandemic?
I think not as much as we would like to. It's not to be selfish or, you know, I don't want to like highlight that we were the only ones, that the Filipinos are the only ones working hard, but looking at the numbers, we are the most impacted. And so I just want the healthcare industry to recognize that, you know, we got to do what's fair. We have to be treated equally. like our other colleagues, and that there should be no discrimination when assignments are being made or are being done. And so I applaud the Nurses of Color, and as well as my other colleagues, because we were all in this together. And I just want what's fair and what's just for all of us.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Zeni Triunfo Cortez, president of National Nurses United. And we will check in now with another guest as we talk about the impact of the pandemic on her work. We're discussing the pandemic's impact on Filipino-American healthcare workers. And with us now is Sherina Castillo, a Filipino-American nurse practitioner of sleep medicine at Community Health Network. Thank you for joining us, Sherina.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
What work do you do as a nurse practitioner? What's your day like?
So typically, I get up in the morning and my daily commute now is walking into my home office and seeing patients with sleep apnea, narcolepsy, various sleep disorders from my home office. And that's actually, you know, COVID has turned everything around, and I've been very lucky to do 100% of my work virtually from home.
That's got to be a huge relief as someone on the front lines to have a little bit extra protection by being able to work from home.
Oh my gosh. To be honest with you, I don't even consider myself to be front lines, just because I am in my own little bubble and I'm working from home and I'm able to be protected. And so, yeah, my heart definitely goes out to everybody who has to actually go to the hospitals and be on the front line, because that certainly is not me at the moment.
What were some of the things you were worried about when the pandemic started?
So I actually was in a different position at the beginning of the pandemic. I was working for a neurology group, and I was seeing patients both in the hospital and in the clinic. And some of my personal concerns were, you know, as a Filipino American, you know, I see my Lola, my grandma. She is mid-70s, and I see her several times a week. And so my biggest concern was potentially taking something from work and bringing it home with me and potentially, you know, getting my loved one sick, especially my elderly grandmother. So that was the biggest concern for me.
Do you have any family also working in the healthcare field aside from yourself?
I do. So my mother is a physical therapist for a rehab hospital here in the city. And then also my aunt and uncle are both nurses. And of course, lots of my friends are in the ICU at Community North. So lots and lots of loved ones and family members in the healthcare field at this time.
And how has that been, having a whole family involved in the healthcare field dealing with the pandemic? What were conversations like at home?
I mean, every day it was just, how are you feeling? How are you doing? How's work? My uncle is actually a nurse in a nursing home here in Indy, and he was one of the unlucky ones, and he had to work in that COVID unit and actually had, you know, he put himself at risk and was working with patients who were positive for COVID. And you know, it was terrifying for me because, again, like my grandma, she's elderly, and the last thing I want is for her to get sick. So, of course, we as a family, we developed a plan, you know, how we would keep each other safe and just how we could go on and still continue to do our jobs and submit to our calling without hurting those around us. So it was tough. It was really tough. You know, stripping down in the garage as soon as you came home and changing into clothes. And yeah, definitely turning everybody's world around for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing back memories of the early lockdown pandemic days when everyone was taking precautions.
Absolutely.
But I would say it seems like, you know, those of us who aren't in the healthcare field might forget that it's still something to be concerned and worried about. Do you think that I guess, you know, have we kind of become laid back about the pandemic?
Honestly, I do believe so. It's easy to just kind of move on and forget everything now that, you know, vaccinations are here and boosters are here and, you know, traveling is becoming more of a thing nowadays again, but, you know, I have so many friends who are still working in the front line at in the ICU at Community North, and, you know, COVID is still here, and a lot of the people affected are those who are not vaccinated. And I mean, this is still very much a real thing, and it's just so important to get vaccinated. And it's not even about just let me do this for me, but it's, you know, do this for the elderly neighbor down the street. Like, do this for those who have no immune system and who can't fight for themselves. It's just so important to just so we can make it through all of this finally.
We've been talking on our program about how many Filipino healthcare workers there are and are continuing to work on the front lines during this pandemic. Being a Filipino American yourself, how does it make you feel to know that so much of your community is on the front line?
I love it. I'm so proud to be Filipino American. And I just love knowing that so many of my fellow Filipinos are out there taking care of others, doing what we do best. It's just, there's something about the Filipino culture that's just so motherly. And, you know, anytime we have guests over, it's, oh, you know, come eat. Like, I mean, like, it's always, you know, we take care of one another. And that's just inherent in all of us. And I love knowing that, you know, in the healthcare field, there's just so many people who are Filipino and just want the best for others and want others to feel better and do better and just heal.
Is there any fear in the community in terms of the pandemic and just having so many on the front lines, just what the future looks like?
I don't think so. I mean, we're all so resilient, but the biggest thing I think now is, you know, mental health is real and depression and anxiety and, you know, seeing the things that Filipino American healthcare workers have seen on the front lines, that is just, it's hard to forget that. And it's hard to just wipe the slate clean at the end of the day, excuse me. And, you know, we have to take care of each other. And whether it's checking in with those who are on the front lines, you know, they are seeing some crazy stuff every single day. And yeah, 3 12-hour shifts a week, that may not sound like much. Oh, you know, you have 4 days off. Yeah, but those 4 days off, like, they are filled with rest and sleeping, eating whatever you can. I mean, mental health is real, and it's just, we have to make sure that those 4 days off, and there's actually recuperation time for those nurses. And especially right now, I mean, I know Community Health Network is just so short that they're begging for people to come and help and pick up extra shifts. And that in of itself is definitely not helping with burnout.
Well, what was the most challenging thing for you during the pandemic?
So kind of going back to the mental health, like the early days of the pandemic, maybe mid-March to early May or late April, I was alone in my house with my little geriatric dog who's 10 years old. Like, I am from a huge Filipino family. There's 10 of us. And several times a week, we would get together for dinner, have a movie night, you know, just get together and just enjoy each other's company. But when everything shut down, it was me, my patients on my laptop, and my dog. And, that was hard for me. I consider myself to be a pretty social person, and to just be cooped up and not have any place to go and not be able to visit my family, my friends, it was really hard for me. And it was really hard talking to some of my friends, like hearing their experiences of, you know, we had another death and they weren't able to see their family members. We had to hold an iPad. I mean, those are just excruciating stories, and to not be able to share those stories with one another in person over a glass of wine, or, you know, just have that face-to-face connection and that in-person connection, that was just so hard. And it really makes you think about what we take for granted.
Yeah. And I think the important point you brought up is the mental health of folks who are working in these very challenging positions, just being able to get the relief that they need.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You mentioned just the difficulty in being able to see family. Has that eased up at all, or are you at all concerned with these new variants that things are going to go backwards?
It has eased up. Thankfully, every person in my family is vaccinated, even my youngest cousin, who is 9 years old. We're all taking the proper precautions and doing everything we can to keep each other safe. I hate it, though. Like, even though our family is getting back together, my grandma is terrified. She doesn't like to do things outside the house anymore. And, you know, I miss those days where we would have, like, you know, oh, fun family field trip, let's go apple picking, or let's go, I don't know, doing some shopping trip or something. And I feel like COVID has definitely instilled a sort of fear in her, and it's definitely hard to, I understand why she's fearful. I mean, she's frail, she's elderly, she's definitely at risk, and I can't rationalize for her. I don't know how else to be like, it's okay, we're taking all the right precautions, you can come with us. So it's hard. I think things definitely aren't the same anymore, but we're doing what we can.
Does it make it harder because you and so many of your family members work in healthcare to have your gatherings that you used to have because you know what's out there and what's the potential?
Right. It's almost kind of like, you know, a little bit too much to make it dangerous. Yeah, absolutely. And with COVID, it's just so unpredictable because I feel like every other day you're just hearing of all these new variants that it's just so hard to predict what's coming around the corner. But honestly, I mean, getting vaccinated, you know, continuing hand washing, wearing masks, that's the best we can do. And we've just remained faithful and hopeful that we're doing everything and everybody's getting vaccinated. Hopefully we can beat this.
What's been the biggest lesson the pandemic has taught you or that you have taken away from all of this?
The biggest thing for me is, I mean, don't take family for granted. As much as, I mean, 10 people in our family, gosh, like, could you imagine a movie night? Like, a movie night is like everybody is talking on top of each other. Like, things can get crazy and everything can get so loud. I always joke, it's like, not that my family's fat, but like my big fat Filipino family, like that's us. Like, everybody's talking, everybody's eating, everybody, you know, is just so excited. But as crazy as it can be at times, like, there is just, you can't replace that energy and that love and just that happiness and joyous feeling of being all together, complete as a family. And that really hit home, you know, when we tried to stagger things and not all be at the house at the same time during the pandemic, it just wasn't the same. And so to all be together at one table, that is just such a blessing. And I really learned not to take that for granted.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Sherina Castillo is a Filipino-American nurse practitioner of sleep medicine at Community Health Network. Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.